Support from Verde Gallery, featuring Dia de los Muertos, a celebration of art, music, words, and dance, starts October 25th and runs through December 4th. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom at 17 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields has an in-store nutritionist, provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, and supplements, as well as a full deli, coffee bar, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, listeners, I welcome your questions for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. I welcome your questions for Susan. If you'd like to talk with her, give us a call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She specializes in developing personalized nutrition plans for athletes and the general public. She is an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's a frequent contributor to magazines on health and fitness, and she is the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. You'll find Susan on the web at www.eatandmove, that's eatnmove.com. She also has an office at Strawberry Fields in Urbana. Questions about diet, nutrition, and exercise? They're invited this afternoon, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Good afternoon. Welcome back.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Good to see you on this rainy day.
That's for sure. A bit of sunshine
here in the studio.
That's good to see you. You too.
We're coming up on the cold and flu season, and I think some people have already been stricken with colds.
I think so.
So maybe this afternoon, got any tips to share in terms of staying healthy? And then if we do get sick, what we might do to speed our recovery?
Right. Well, I think when you think about cold and flu season and just trying to keep your immunity up, that's probably the biggest thing to begin with. And really looking at trying to make sure, and this may sound kind of elementary at the beginning, but certainly making sure you're getting enough rest, because we know that makes a big difference. Making sure you're not skipping meals, because I think sometimes our schedules change. You know, this is kind of a funny time of year and our schedules change a little bit, and we might get in a hurry to do this with the difference in the light or the light that we don't see, I guess, after work and things. Just making sure that you're not skipping meals, I think, is really important, because when you think of overall nutrition, it's so important to make sure that you're getting in sound nutrients every day. I think it's really crucial, kind of as a, you know, sort of as a baseline, to make sure that you're taking a multivitamin, multimineral that's appropriate for you and your age. I think that's important all the time, but especially through the winter, that's a key thing to be looking at doing. Making sure that you're trying to really bump up fruit and vegetable intake. We find for a lot of people they do really well in the summer, and particularly when they can get a lot of things at the farmers markets, and then it goes down, or they don't feel like eating that much fruit or things like that once the weather gets colder. So it's really important when you think about natural antioxidants and where they're found. We still have more research on fruit and vegetable intake than anything else in terms of trying to stay healthy and prevent disease. So those are some key things to really keep trying to say, you know, we shoot for this 5 a day. I'm really more into about 8 a day in terms of fruits and vegetables. And it's not that difficult to get when you think that includes some juice, that includes servings, really only about a half cup, so it's not that difficult. But reminding yourself, even doing simple things like taking some V8 or taking some 6 ounce grapefruit juices into work, so you've got a little snack there, you've got some things that you can do real easily. I think that's crucial as a baseline, is to make sure you're not skipping meals, you've got your multivitamin, multimineral, you're trying to continue to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables for starters. And then we look at other things like, boy, it might help to add a little bit more vitamin C. It might help to add some extra vitamin E. Are you going to get that in food or get that in supplementation or maybe both in terms of some other nutrients? And making sure even some simple things we know, like often people enjoy tea, but they don't drink much of it. But now is a good time, even as a preventative measure, to drink a little bit more tea that might be high in some of these antioxidants or immune enhancers. You know, something like astragalus, which is an herbal tea that I like, that certainly that's one of the herbs that is kind of in the community of herbs that may be helpful in terms of immune function. And so you can find these things real readily, and that's a simple thing to do, have a couple glasses of hot tea that maybe are a particular herbal tea that might be beneficial in terms of enhancing immunity too.
Okay. In terms of extra vitamin C, there's also some feeling, some understanding that zinc might also help. And
right.
Would you advise people to take an extra supplement?
Well, I think, particularly when you look at extra vitamin C, I think, you know, we don't have clear-cut evidence that, yes, you take more vitamin C, you won't get more colds. That certainly is debatable still. But we do know that for some people, boosting up that vitamin C, even at lower levels of maybe 250 milligrams twice a day, something like that, so you can keep your vitamin C levels a little bit higher, could definitely be beneficial. And in terms of zinc, there's such a small window of how much is too much zinc.
Mm-hmm.
So what I always recommend people do is make sure in their multivitamin it's also a multimineral and it has zinc in there. So you get 100% of the zinc right there, so that's not going to be a problem. Once you start supplementing with a lot of extra zinc, you may malabsorb copper and have other problems too. So it's just one of those, kind of like vitamin A. There's not a big window of if you supplement a lot more, you might run into other problems. And so things like the lozenges with zinc and vitamin C added and things like that certainly might be beneficial, particularly when a cold's coming on and when you're feeling that. But chronically supplementing with these large amounts might be a little more problematic.
Okay. So again, in food, where is zinc found?
Zinc is found in meats. It's found some in nuts and seeds and beans and things like that,
okay,
dried beans and peas. So generally, if you're getting some of these alternative protein sources, you might be getting a little bit more zinc as well.
Okay, very good. So there again, you can turn to food,
right,
as your source for just a well-balanced diet, and then your multivitamin, you should be in good shape.
Right.
In terms of exercise, I found an article on the web that actually involved some researchers here at the University of Illinois in Urbana looking at exercise, and if you're an exerciser, just moderate,
mm-hmm,
not an athlete or anything like that,
yeah,
but moderate exercise, you'll come through flu better.
Great.
So very interesting. Moderate exercise helped mice survive the flu in a recent lab test done by researchers at the U of I.
Hmm.
So, and it's not a lot of exercise, you know. They can't remember. Let me look down the article here. It says, it's worth noting that the mice weren't hardcore rodent athletes. They only exercised moderately for a handful of days. None exercised regularly before the experiment. So,
yeah. Well, and I think when you think about what exercise does, I mean, naturally exercise makes us feel better in terms of hormone changes where we feel better. It certainly helps get more blood flow to our cells in the body, and that's good. And we know that exercise in a moderate level does enhance immunity. Really, the only time we see detrimental effects of exercise is really, very large amounts, endurance or ultra-endurance athletes sometimes have a little bit more problem with immunity. But generally, regular exercisers, or like you're saying, just maybe being moderately active is something. And again, that's important because we do see this shift of, just like with diet, when people often tend to eat better in the summer and maybe not as well in the winter, the same thing happens with exercise. Often people are more active around here in the summer. It's easier to be. You can be outside more. And then that kind of drops off. And so just at the time when we might be more susceptible, we're inside more, we're around more germs, the windows aren't open, all these things, we may not be as active too. So that's certainly an important thing to look at your arsenal of how you're going to try to stay healthy.
Let's talk with a listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about margarine. When I switched from using butter to margarine a while back, I found that it's not even close to the same. Like if you try to make some spread your margarine on toast, like it gets all soggy, and so I decided I didn't like it. But then I started using this margarine from the local dairy producer around here,
mm-hmm.
and it's just much, much better. It's not even close to the same. It has the same consistency as butter, and so I've been using this all the time. But then I got to thinking, well, why is it so much better, and is that healthy? Are there different products in it? And I don't think it's dairy products. I know there's some products that are part margarine and part butter, but this is not one of them. And mm-hmm. even though it's made by a dairy company, it's just 100% margarine. And I know it says, I'm looking at the box now, it says total fat is, the largest amount is the monounsaturated.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next one is the polyunsaturated, and then the next one is the saturated. That's in the 5.5, 3.5, and 2 grams.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what the other ones have in them, but I'm just wondering if you had any idea why this one would somehow be like less watery than the other ones, and then if it has anything to do with the ingredients. And I surfed around on the internet, and it claimed that the monounsaturated is actually the best one.
Right.
So I was wondering if you have any idea what the heck that's all about.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's an interesting question, because I think this idea of margarine versus butter versus which type of margarine and all these things is always going to be an issue, because there's all kinds of products and all kinds of choices that are out there. And some of the margarines that are on the market say no trans fat, very low saturated fat, if any. And, you know, if you look at some of them that are much lower in fat, often they are higher in water. Like you're saying, maybe they have more water that's actually built into the margarine or produced with a little bit more fluid, and the type of saturated fat is different, or there's very little at all. So what you have is a product that maybe doesn't spread as well, maybe doesn't melt as well in some cases, which might be some of the things that you had, which are also often lower in the saturated fat. The product that you have that's got 2 grams of saturated fat is certainly better than butter, and it's better than some of the very hard margarines that are out there. But it may be enough more saturated fat that it actually tastes more creamy, spreads better for you, and things like that. And I think that when you look at margarine and butter, it's a matter of, first of all, you know, looking at what's your risk. If you use a lot of margarine or you use a lot of butter and you're concerned about saturated fat or you're concerned about cardiovascular disease, that might be a place where you want to make a switch to one that's trans fatty, acid-free, or no saturated fat. And give up some of that, you know, change in consistency or flavor or things like that. But if it's still a concern, but it's not a major concern for you and you don't use a lot of it, you may enjoy something like this product that certainly is still better because it's higher in monounsaturated fat, which is just like you said, the type we want more of. It's got some saturated fat, more than some, but it's still not as high as what you would find in something like hard butter or very, very hard margarine. And so what you've got here is probably a product that you know, gives you a little bit of both worlds, in that more monounsaturated fat that's good. At the same time, it's more spreadable because it has a little bit of saturated fat too.
So the ones that were watery, I mean, they weren't like health products or anything like that. They were just other ones, and it was several of them that I just pulled off the shelf in the grocery store. But I mean, maybe they made them, you know, just to make them to save money. They put in less of the more expensive ingredients, but. I didn't think they would have made them to be more healthy. So I guess I should look at what their ingredients are.
Right.
So you think, but this, if it has a lot of monounsaturated, then it's probably, my biggest worry was that it was like, it tasted better, but, you know, I was having a very enjoyable experience of coating my arteries, you know, that was the biggest thing.
Well, I think in this case, again, this is probably a middle of the road margarine, in that it's, it's definitely more beneficial than some. You will find some, you know, if you look at the total fat from what you said in terms of grams, maybe this is 11 grams per tablespoon or so, you'll find some margarines that are much less than that. But part of the reason they are is because they do have more water whipped into them. And so they're not going to have the same consistency, even if they're going to be a little bit better for you. And so, again, in this case, it's kind of like the scenario for a lot of people, what they like to do and what I recommend is maybe mixing butter half and half with olive oil. And you blend that up in a blender and it becomes more of a liquidy type margarine. It's much higher in monounsaturated fat, but it still has some saturated fat. And so for a lot of people, they like that type of thing, which is probably kind of similar to what you've got here in that it's a breakdown. You've definitely got more monos, which we like. You still have that creaminess. You still have some of the buttery flavor. And it's kind of in the middle road there.
Okay, so a little bit's not too bad.
Right, right.
Okay.
I think the thing you want to look at with margarine, too, is sometimes we become very concerned about margarine, but then we might have two or three cookies that are very high in saturated fat because they're made with, lard, or they're made with more really saturated type of margarine or something. And so the whole thing is to think about your overall diet. This might be a place you really enjoy some. It's not that much, and you're not getting in a lot of other places, whereas for some other people, they're getting it several places, so they might want to look at saying, hey, margarine's an easy place for me to cut out a little bit more fat in my diet.
Okay. Okay, just wanted to make sure the heart attack didn't occur in my 50s, like the wait until I was in my 70s or something.
Well, I think you obviously, you know, for cardiovascular health, choosing a good margarine is one thing you want to do, and looking at your total diet and looking at your exercise and stress levels and those things, it's the combination that's the most important, really.
Okay. Okay, sounds good.
Okay, thanks for the call. I've had a similar experience with peanut butter. You
mm-hmm.
know, there are peanut butters that, you know, if you put the peanut butter on warm toast, it gets soggy.
Right, right.
So it's a saturated fat issue.
Some of it,
yeah,
I think some of it is saturated fat. Some of it is any other, what are the other ingredients that they might add to products to make them more creamy seeming, or again, if there's extra fluid added or things like that, or a lot of the natural peanut butters too, you know, if the liquid goes to the top, which is basically the peanut oil, and then some people will just pour that off, and then it's difficult to spread the other because it's low, and the creaminess factor is not really there. So it's a matter of maybe pouring some of that off. Of course, a lot of that is more monounsaturated fat anyway, coming from peanuts. So, yeah, so peanut butter, I think maybe because I love peanut butter so much, I might be biased, but I think, you know, it's such a good, again, another good source of zinc. It's a good source of protein. It's got fiber and other things, too. The whole thing with peanut butter is the amount, and that can be the tricky part because a tablespoon of peanut butter really can fit into any diet, in my estimation, but once you get a quarter cup or something like that, then it starts adding up to a lot of calories.
Yeah, and if you like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with the peanut butter on there, pretty...
Right.
Pretty thick. Yeah, you could come up with a quarter of a cup pretty easily.
Right.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Downs on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Land O'Lakes is making a product that is half butter and half canola oil that is just on the supermarket shelves. I've been doing that for years and years, and it's just convenient to have it already made up for me.
Yeah, sure.
My question is about forms of calcium. I had a rather severe automobile accident a couple of years ago and had to have bone grafts and things. And I asked my doctor about calcium, and he said, yeah, you should take some. And I said, well, after I looked, then I came back and said, what form? And he was just, he didn't know. But there's a bewildering array of calciums out there with this and that and the other thing added, and I don't know which is better.
Well, and it is tricky with calcium. Different researchers might say different things. The most important thing with calcium, I think, is to try to maximize it from diet. It may be a little bit better absorbed from the dietary sources like milk and things like that, or calcium fortified orange juice, although it's not been out there that long. From the researchers I've talked to, particularly some at Purdue who research this area, you know, they feel like it's pretty well absorbed. Form of calcium, and looking at trying to break that down during the day. We do know that calcium is, some of it is how well it's absorbed, and if you get it several times during the day, it may be better absorbed rather than a whole lot at one time. And the same thing with the supplement. Usually you can get a supplement in 500 milligrams or 1,000 milligrams. And what I really tell people is that if they really know they're only going to take it once a day, certainly take the 1,000 if they need 1,000, because you will absorb still, you know, more than half of that. A lot of times people say, well, gosh, if I take over 500, I'm not going to absorb any more of that. And that's not necessarily true. You'll absorb more, but the more you take at one time, the decreased percentage is that you will absorb. So generally, if you take it in supplemental form, whether it's calcium carbonate or whether it's another form of calcium, your best bet is to say, well, can I maximize it in diet first? If I need to take 500 or 1,000 milligrams, can I break that down, at least if it's 1,000, break it down into twice a day? And looking at other ways that might enhance the absorption, because as much as the form, it's things like if you take calcium and you have an iron supplement with it, if you take a multivitamin with iron, let's say, take it at the same time as a lot of calcium, you're probably not going to absorb as much of that calcium because the iron and the calcium compete for binding sites. And if you take it with a lot of caffeine, caffeine tends to decrease the absorption of some minerals, so may decrease calcium or iron absorption. And so generally you want to look at some of these other things in your diet to see that maybe you have coffee, you know, after you take it or not necessarily with it, or it's decaf, or same thing with tea or something like that, so it doesn't tend to decrease the absorption nearly as much. And so it seems to me that the reviews that I read look more at just making sure you're getting the right amount in and it's varied throughout the day, as opposed to just looking at the form that it's in, because every manufacturer is going to say that their form is better in some way or the other. And so when you look at all the reviews that are really out there, that's what I kind of focus on in terms of the amounts, getting it in food, breaking it down during the day, and looking at anything else that might be hampering the absorption of the calcium.
So nobody has any, I mean, I'm not thinking right now of all the ways they come, but it comes with D and it comes with magnesium. Mm-hmm. It comes with, you know, I'm sure you know all these things. And so it really doesn't matter?
Well, generally when you look at what it comes with, most of the products now will have D because D does help with absorption. Generally they'll have some, often they'll have magnesium in them too. And that's what you could look for. I mean, certainly if you're looking for whether they have anything else in them or not, I would get a product that has vitamin D in it for sure, and possibly also magnesium in it, but okay. For sure vitamin D.
Okay.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Also, some time ago we had a physician on the program who was very much, he had written a book about osteoporosis, and one of the things that he really emphasized over and over and over again was exercise, mm-hmm. How important exercise is in prevention of osteoporosis. And I'm wondering if you had any suggestions in terms of exercise that would be good, but again, you know, moderate and
right.
Something that we could all do.
Well, usually when we think about what's going to be bone strengthening exercise, we think of something that where we have to carry our weight. And so that's where if you look at walking, or if you look at, let's say, walking more so than bicycling, because with walking you're actually lifting your body and you're having to carry your body weight. And so that makes your bones stronger, having to do that. And the same thing with weightlifting, because we do find that weightlifting can increase the bone mass as well. And so you look at some type of strength training exercises. And again, that might even be you're up against a wall and you're doing push-ups against the wall because it's your own body weight.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily have to be heavy weight training programs. But, you know, nowadays we do see particular workouts and exercise programs geared towards osteoporosis prevention or towards people with osteoporosis. And so often they will include some type of, you know, exercise where you do have to lift your body in some way, or you have to push, or you have to use your muscle or lift your muscle with your bone, because that tends to be helpful too. Kind of along those lines, you know, since I do a lot of work with athletes and younger athletes, what I've been seeing a lot even as well is just chronically under eating, and how we often think, you know, let's say if someone's not eating enough calories consistently, even if they're exercising well and all these things, the exercise certainly helps prevent osteoporosis in some aspects, but we're finding more problems with stress fractures and bones not being as strong as they would normally be. if particularly females, if they're chronically eating less than they require, because no matter if you're getting enough calcium or if you're getting enough of these other nutrients, it appears that if your total calories are lower on a consistent basis than what you require, then that puts you at risk for stress fractures and certainly osteoporosis perhaps down the road. So I think, you know, on the one hand, we have all this information out there about obesity and how we're too overweight as a country, mm-hmm. and certainly that's a big concern. And I think on the other hand, we do have a lot of people maybe who are undernourished by choice and maybe thinking that they need to be a little bit lower weight than they do need to be. We know that very low weight individuals are at higher risk for osteoporosis too. And so part of that is maybe just chronically being malnourished. The other part of it may be that they're not lifting as much on their body when they're walking and doing basic things because their muscle mass is smaller. And so they may not be getting the benefit.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, a caller on campus, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if she can tell your feelings on creatine supplements.
Sure. Creatine actually, you know, in the last several years has been a lot of good studies on creatine. Creatine is a supplement that it helps, or it's proposed to actually help with, particularly with weight training or with strength type exercise, to regenerate ATP or regenerate energy in the muscle to be able to lift harder and work out harder. With generally, it's often used with strength training or power lifting or, you know, sports like football, maybe, where you're looking at really increasing lean mass, those types of things. And from, you know, from the studies, there are a lot of good studies that have found that maybe 50% or maybe even more of the athletes in a lot of these studies have seen better gains when they've taken creatine. And so it's one of the few ergogenic aids or type of supplements that for athletes has been looked at very closely through the years, and with very sound studies. And so it's a supplement that if your main goal is to get bigger, if your main goal is to increase size and power and strength, it may be worth looking at as a supplemental addition to what you're doing. Again, generally what I find with athletes I work with is we need to make sure they're getting enough food. We need to make sure, for instance, I had a football player not long ago, wanted to take it, but he wasn't eating breakfast. Well, we know the first thing is you got to get enough calories. You have to get enough protein. You know, your protein needs are higher when you're trying to gain lean body mass. And so all those things should be in place first before you start adding some different supplements to the mix. The other thing we know about creatine is that almost all the studies have been in after a loading phase of creatine, generally pretty low doses, maybe 2 to 5 grams a day of creatine. And a lot of the products on the market recommend 10 grams, 20 grams a day. So we don't have studies on these high amounts of creatine on a daily basis to know, is that safe? Is it not? Initially, we thought that perhaps there was some problems with heat regulation with creatine and maybe muscle strains and pulls. And certainly we see that anecdotally. But to my knowledge, the studies really haven't proven that, yes, there are some major problems if someone takes it in these smaller amounts. On the other hand, what I would say too, and with a couple of the universities I work with, what we recommend is that you try to maximize it in food. Now, creatine is found primarily in red meat sources and fish. And so lean red meat, pork, beef, and fish primarily is where you find it. And so for many athletes who are eating 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 calories a day because they're that size of athlete, they can get 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 grams of creatine a day in food. And so this is kind of the approach that we take at a lot of universities to try to maximize it in food first. If that's unacceptable or they can't do it, then maybe they're looking at a creatine source too. The big thing, of course, with any supplement like creatine, we tend to see more supplements that are marketed as ergogenic aids or muscle builders that also might be tainted with something else, because those tend to be popular supplements that we tend to see other pro-hormones or things added to, even if they're not on the label. So you'd want to have a reputable place that you buy it. You want to make sure that it's a reputable company. You want to make sure you don't take too much of it. You want to make sure you stay hydrated if you take it. And then the other big question I get a lot is, how about if you're under 18? Because all these studies have been age 18 and over athletes, mostly men, but there have been certainly studies on females too.
Anyone over 40?
Oh, gosh, I think there have been studies over 40, certainly. You know, creatine's being studied for a lot of different things now, even in some disease states, you know, to maybe help keep muscle tone and things like that. And so it's certainly being studied on a wide range, but this younger population of junior high and high school athletes, we really don't have the studies there to say, is the safety okay at this point? We don't have those studies. But overall, most of the studies that are out there have been pretty clear that for some athletes, we call them either responders or non-responders. Some people will respond to it if they're training really hard. They may see extra benefit. Some people, if they don't see extra benefit in the first couple months, they're probably not responders. Their creatine stores are probably high enough already that extra creatine is not going to be beneficial. We do tend to see a little bit more benefit in vegetarians because they don't tend to get as much natural creatine in the diet, very little often. And so having some of this extra creatine may be more beneficial there.
How about would it be okay as a supplement just to say recover quicker from exercise, or and your goal isn't to get bigger or stronger? Or, I mean, well, at least not bigger.
Right. I don't know that I've seen many studies looking at recovery with creatine, even though some of them are marketed to have it right after your workout and things like that. Mostly what the studies have looked at is muscle size, muscle strength increasing with creatine use in combination with a really sound weightlifting program. That's generally what you look at, is does strength training, is it enhanced with creatine use for strength training? And so at least the ones I'm familiar with have looked at it more that way, not necessarily recovery.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Next, we talk with a listener on line 4 in Marshall. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question about vitamin B12. In multivitamins, you get about almost everything, one multivitamin a day. But in a publication that came recently, it said that vitamin B12 can be canceled out by other vitamins. What about that? It said that you take it either alone or with folic acid and then wait at least an hour before you take the other vitamin. So what about the multivitamins then?
Well, it's true that often, particularly as we age, often a B12 vitamin for some people may be recommended as an additional vitamin just because we don't absorb it very well. And that might be part of what you read, is that it's not as easily absorbed. It tends to be absorbed better, particularly after age 50 or so, if you get it in a supplemental form in addition to what you have in food. And B12 is found primarily in animal sources, so in meats and other animal sources. If someone's completely vegan, generally they do supplement with B12 because it's hard to get enough of it otherwise. But the whole issue with B12 as we age tends to be the absorption factor. And so sometimes taking that as a separate vitamin, and sometimes, again, with folate, or you might see it with maybe one other B vitamin added to it, may be better absorbed at that point too. B12 is one of those vitamins, kind of like vitamin D, that particularly, again, as we get older, we tend to be low in these vitamins. And so these might be some, and you'll see more research on these too, that taking a multi is great, but sometimes we might need extra of those as well. And particularly vitamin D, you know, you look at a day like today in Champaign-Urbana and you think, well, of course, we're not getting any vitamin D today. And in the, you know, in the Midwest or upper Midwest, or certainly the mid-level and above in terms of this country, people generally don't get nearly enough vitamin D too. So there are some researchers who really recommend, you know, considerable extra vitamin D, because we're finding so many people are low in their stores of vitamin D as well. But B12, you know, the main food sources of B12, oysters are probably the highest in terms of the amount of B12, and Alaskan crab and ground beef and salmon and things like that. So again, you'll see that they're primarily fish and meat sources and things like that. But I think if you're concerned about B12, that might be something worth getting checked too.
I'm just wondering then why it's included in the multivitamin. If that's the case, I wondered.
Right. Well, I'm not.
I think we lost the caller, so we'll go ahead and answer. And
okay.
Hopefully she can turn her radio up now and hear us.
Well, I think some of that may be that when you look at a multivitamin, multimineral, you know, we may not absorb all that from what's in there, but for many people, that's what they're going to take. They're going to take one multivitamin, multimineral, and certainly getting B12 is an important vitamin to add into that. And so, you know, I think it certainly would be almost every vitamin and mineral, you would want to look at that and say, well, what enhances absorption, what decreases mm-hmm. absorption? There are ways that you could almost look at almost every one with that. But I think B12, because we've seen it lower or being low in more people, I think that's something to keep an eye on, because there may be more reasons out there that I'm not aware of to take it separately. But as far as I know right now, we often, even if somebody has cardiovascular disease, we usually recommend extra B vitamins to help with keeping homocysteine levels down and things like that. So you look, usually it's B12 and folate and B6 and some of these ones together, either in a multi or as a separate
okay.
supplement.
Let's talk with another listener, a listener on line 2 in Aurora. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I wondered if there was anything you could say about blood pressure and the lowering of it by any food intake?
Sure.
Is there any such thing? I know it's low sodium.
Yeah. Well, probably the best studies that have come out in the last several years on blood pressure have been what we call the DASH studies. I don't know if you're familiar with those. Just
no.
D-A-S-H. And they've been studies that have looked at, basically we call them the dietary approaches to stopping hypertension. That's where they get DASH. Mm. And there have been a number of studies that I believe originated at Harvard and some research institutes in Boston area, and have looked at combinations of food. And basically, if you look at the diets on these DASH programs, they've been pretty low in sugar. Of course, not a lot of added salt or sodium, because like you said, that's definitely one factor and one concern. But they also tend to be higher in fiber, higher in calcium and magnesium. There have been a lot of studies lately looking at the role of calcium in blood pressure, and maybe getting more calcium in the diet might also help keep blood pressure down. So these diets are basically, if you looked at the diet, they'd be quite high in fruits and vegetables, maybe 6 or 7 servings of fruits and vegetables. Grains are primarily whole grains. You're getting more fiber there, more B vitamins, maybe 1 serving of nuts or seeds a day, and that would, of course, help with magnesium and zinc and some of these other minerals, and then generally 3 or 4 servings of a high-calcium food a day. For most of us, if we ate all that, we wouldn't have a lot of room for sweets or snack foods or things like that, too. So the diets are basically pretty balanced, but what appears to be a little bit different is calcium is also high enough, and maybe magnesium and some of these other nutrients. And so that's certainly an important thing to look at.
And stress also plays a part.
Sure, stress plays a part. Like Celeste mentioned earlier, just exercise, because, of course, with blood pressure, the activity that you can do can help keep you healthier, keep your blood vessels healthier, and that's all important when you look at having high blood pressure, is being able to maintain any type of exercise program you can do. And then it's basically, like you're saying, we used to think just, you know, low salt diet, but it's more than that. It's keeping your weight down, because if we're more at an ideal body weight, that tends to help blood pressure. I've had many clients I've worked with who have gotten off blood pressure medications if they've seen even 10, 15 pounds weight loss, because part of that is extra weight that it's harder for their body to, you know, pump blood through, basically. And so weight loss is a really key component with anybody who has blood pressure. We really look closely at that as well.
Well, I think my biggest problem is stress. I better get doing more exercises then.
Yeah, and maybe looking at yoga or other relaxation things that you could do too, because I think that the whole area of some of these other types of exercise that are more relaxing for the body and ways that you can relax, Tai Chi and things like that, certainly we know can really help with stress levels and at the same time are great exercise.
Let me say this for anybody that has problems sleeping. I do the stress relaxation exercises before I go to sleep, and I just sleep great, the best in years.
What?
So it's been a double plus for me.
What specifically do you do?
Well, you know, the closing of your eyes about 5 times, then the opening up your mouth 5 times, and then moving your head from side to side, flexing your upper arm, flexing your lower arm, stretching your hands, the fingers back and forth about 5 times, and then trying to pick up your shoulders off the bed. I do everything about 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I go all the way down my body parts that way. And I just can't believe how wonderful it is to really sleep a relaxing sleep.
That's great, and that sounds like a real good method, you know, the method of definitely going through your whole body and trying to relax and get ready to sleep. That's fantastic.
It really is. That's one of the pluses in this situation, to find a relaxation exercise that gives you such a really good sleep, too. Mm. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we talk with a listener in the Chicago area on line one. Good afternoon.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I was recently put on Coumadin, and I'm hoping it's just temporary. Right now, it's on 5 milligrams, which I think is sort of a moderate dose. I'm wondering, I know there are some herbs and supplements that are contraindicated because they intensify the effect of the Coumadin. I think ginkgo is one. Bilberry, and I'm wondering if there's what you could tell me about that.
Sure. When you look at Coumadin, and generally people go on the medication Coumadin if they, you know, have to control blood clotting or making sure, you know, something to do, anything to do with the clotting factor. And so generally on Coumadin, of course, like you're saying, maybe food-wise, you've been told to maybe keep your diet stable in terms of green vegetables and leafy vegetables and things like that that might affect, based on vitamin K, might affect blood clotting.
The vitamin K would counteract the effect, right, rather than intensify.
Right, exactly. And so,
but I'm wondering also, what are the things that intensify it?
Well, like you're saying, things like, if you look at the herbs like ginkgo or bilberry, if you look at garlic is thought of as a, you know, can have a side effect of actually, you know, as a blood thinner, basically. Mm. And so it would sort of work with Coumadin and some of these other herbs, too, the same type of thing. They might be sort of a blood thinner. You know, you look at willow, like willow bark is an herb that's in a lot of things that it's basically got the same component as aspirin. So it's kind of a blood thinner as well.
I thought willow bark worked differently than aspirin.
Well, it may work differently, but it does have similar components as aspirin in it.
Mm.
And so there are many herbs. I think the biggest thing, if you're on a medication that is a blood thinner or any type of medication that affects blood clotting, then you do want to look very closely at any supplement you're taking and make sure, you know, the best bet is probably not to take a lot of extra things now, because one of the things we know about some supplements is that we're not really sure of all the interactions with foods or with drugs, or it's just like a lot of drugs. We still find interactions that we didn't know about, and so we have to be careful with that. So keeping your diet pretty stable on Coumadin is generally one good recommendation. The other thing that I've had clients who started taking Coumadin but also then wanted to take large amounts of vitamin E, and vitamin E can serve as a blood thinner too. So that can be problematic if you have too much vitamin E. So So like you say, there are other things that can affect it as well. And so,
I see. That, nothing else specifically that comes to your mind that's striking that would be contraindicated because it intensifies it?
No, not necessarily, although I will just say that whenever you do searches on different herbs, they might be some very obscure herbs, but many of them will come up that a side effect might be blood thinning too. And so this is probably a real small number of the large number of ones that could be problematic. Yeah,
I see. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And we've taken care of all our callers this afternoon. Good number of callers. Thanks to those folks who called in this afternoon. Thanks to everyone who is listening this afternoon. Before we go, we just have a minute left here. You mentioned in the discussion about B12, folate. Is folate the same thing as folic acid?
Yes, it is. It is. It's a vitamin as well. And that's why often you might see some of these B vitamins together. And actually, I'll have to look up some more on that B12, but I do know that is something we start looking at pretty closely. Not that 50 is the magic number, because of course we're all different in terms of what we need, but we just know that digestively we tend to not absorb B12 as well as we get older. And some of that has to do with the gut and the status of your intestinal system and things like that. And, you know, another I guess, something we didn't mention about immunity, but I might take this chance to do it too, is looking at any way you can keep your intestinal system healthy during this time, particularly during the winter. And I'm certainly a big believer in what you can do with probiotics, or whether that's in yogurt or kefir or maybe supplemental probiotic thing to look at. If you maintain a healthy immune system in terms of your gut or a healthy digestive system, there's certainly studies to find that that helps your immunity overall. And so you absorb nutrients better, you can digest food better, all these things. And so that is a kind of another factor, like we talked about, to maybe add on to those at the beginning of the show, that certainly digestively try to do what you can so that you keep a healthy digestive tract. Make sure you're getting enough fiber. Make sure you're moving things through on a consistent basis and things, so you hopefully will absorb and digest nutrients better.
Very good. Well, thank you, Susan, once again for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
We'll see you in December. How about that?
Hard to believe.
Okay. Susan Kundrat is a registered dietitian. She is a sports and wellness nutritionist and owner of Nutrition on the Move. She's an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And she's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. And you can find her on the web at www.eatandmove. That's EatandMove.com. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, wheat futures crashing down again today. That after a fairly rough and hard technically traded Friday last week when they had a reversal down. December futures in the wheat pit were down 10 and a quarter since this afternoon at the settlement price at 306 and a quarter, a high there at 304, or rather at 314, and a low at 304 and a half. March wheat futures at 325 and a half high, low at 316 and three quarter. Settlement price today, 319. They were off 9.5 cents. In the May wheat futures, 330 the high, the low at 322 and three quarters. Settled 324 and a half. They were off a dime. July contract, 334 the high, the low at 326. Settlement price at 327 and a half. They finished 9.5 cents lower. From the corn pit, December futures, 202 and a half the high, the low at 199 and a quarter. Settled $2 even. They were down 2.5 cents. March contract now, 213 the high, the low at 210 and a half. Settled 211, down 2 cents. In the May contract, at 220 and a half high, low at 218 and a quarter. Settled 218 and three quarters, down a penny and three quarters. July futures in the corn pit, 227 and a quarter the high, the low 224 and three quarters. Settlement price there, 225 and a quarter. They were off 2 and a quarter for the day. And the September contract, a 234 high, low at 232 and a quarter. Settled 232 and a half, down 1 3/4. December futures, 242 the high, the low at 240 and a half. Settled 241 and a half, down 1 1/2 for the day. December oat contract, 141 and a quarter the high, the low at 139 and a quarter. Settled 139 and a half, down 3 1/4 cents. And the March contract, a 148 and a quarter high, low at 146. Settled 146 and a quarter. They were off 3 1/4 for the day. From the soy complex, nearby November beans, 526 the high, the low at 515 and a half. Settled the day at 518. They were off 9 1/2 cents. The wire service saying that really wasn't much happening in the bean pit. And just because they decided to push them lower, no new fundamental news to trade on. January futures, 530 the high, the low at 518 and a half. Settlement price at 521 and a half. They were down 12 cents today. March contract, 537 and a half the high, low at 525, settled 527 and a half, down 12 and three quarters. And the May soybeans, 544 and a half the high, the low at 532. Settled 534 and a quarter, down 12 and a quarter for the day. July contract in the bean pit, 549 and a half the high, low at 538 and a half. Settlement price at 541, down 13 and a quarter. And the August soybeans finished 12 cents lower, 543 their settlement price, the high at 549, the low at 541. From the bean meal pit, December contract, 152.70 the high, the low at 150. Settlement price at 150.10 for the December bean meal, down 380 for the day, and the January contract off $4.20 with a high of 154, a low at 151.30, and a settlement price a dime above that at 151.40. From the bean oil now, December contract, 21.45 the high, low at 21.03, settled $21.18 a pound. They were off 32 cents, and the January contract off 30 with a settlement price at 21.28, the high there at 21.52. And the January bean oil low at 21.50. 15. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Lower day today for cattle, while lean hogs and February bellies were higher. In fact, February bellies finished limit up today. November feeder cattle, the high 109.30, the low 108.50, finishing at 108.70, that down 50. January 105.85, the high 104.60, the low 104.67.5, the settlement, that down 85. March feeder cattle, 101.80, the high 101, even the low 101.20, the settlement, that down 60. December live cattle, 84.22.5, the high 83.55, the low 83.95, the settlement, that down 52.5. February 87.15, the high 86.45, the low 87 even, the settlement, that down 20. December lean hog, 69.35, the high 67.70, the low 69.17.5, the settlement, that up 172.5. February lean hog, 69.20, the high 67.50, the low 69.17.5, the settlement, that up 197.5. April lean hog, 66.75, the high 64.80, the low, finishing at 66.62.5, up 187.5. May lean hog, 66.32.5, the high 65.20, the low 66.02.5, the settlement, that up 80. And February bellies, 97.80, the high 95, even the low 97.80, the settlement, that finishing limit up $3. And the Dow is up 31 points at 10,059. The NASDAQ 5 higher at 1980. And the S&P 500 up a fraction at 1131.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Mitch Mitchell from Columbia, Missouri writes, Dear Dr. Science, recently in Greece, a strange ancient toy dated from 100 AD was dug out. It is a shallow metal sphere set in a stand around a vertical axis from its top to bottom. Three 90-degree L-shaped hollow tubes extend out from its cavity, 120 degrees apart along its equatorial line with their end openings pointing along the tangents. If you boil some water in the ball, steam will shoot out of the openings of three tubes, and the ball will spin around the axis. What was the purpose of this toy?
It was a feeble attempt at patent infringement. Being natural clairvoyants, the ancient Greeks were well aware that Elihu Cook would invent the steam engine in 1845, but they missed the application of this new technology to useful work. How like the ancient Greeks to rhapsodize about wine, women, and song and miss the big payoff in assembly lines and factory work.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's.